We're beginning the third of these three segments of the course that I outlined at the beginning. We were tracking these three kinds of issues in architecture based on the Vitruvian Triad, where Vitruvius said that architecture must deal with firmness, commodity, and delight. So we dealt with the delight in terms of issues of form for the first one-third of the semester. And then we dealt with issues of firmness or physical considerations in the second part of the semester, culminating with the test last Tuesday. And now for the end of the semester, we'll be dealing with the third of those issues, which Vitruvius called commodity, and which we will refer to as human factors. So just as with this kind of expansion of those Vitruvian terms that we've used all semester, commodity is terribly important. How do buildings accommodate human use? But we're going to be looking at more than just accommodation. We're also looking at psychology, at sociology, at meaning, at communication. How do buildings really interact with us in terms of our desires, our emotions, our psyche, our psychology, in the way that we live our everyday lives? So today we're going to be dealing with the designation and organization of use. Really, primarily what we're talking about today is function. How does function inspire and shape architecture? And it's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, I think maybe one of the biggest things the lay public would say is important in architecture is that it be functional. It's ridiculous if a building is not functional. A lot of complaints if there's a perception this building is not functional. That's wrong. That's not the way it should be. So this is definitely a big and important issue in architecture, is how does it actually function? So I want to begin, and actually I want to pick up a little bit from last time, because we're going to do a kind of parallel exercise today. But in the last lecture on physical considerations, we were talking about climate, and the Twitter card question at the end was, okay, in 10 years, how important are climatic factors, thermal issues, how a building responds to the sun, heat, cold? How important is that to you in choosing a home? And these were some of the answers that we got to that Twitter card question. Someone says, this lecture has made me realize that my family's house in the suburbs of Houston goes against literally all of the preferred design criteria for a climatically stable home. This is why I will do everything I can to live in a house one day that takes climate into account completely in its design. There is no enriching the conditions of nature. Someone else says, I love the idea of using climate, natural light, and saving energy. I love the feeling of being outdoors. Therefore, I would go to the home that uses all the natural climate and light. It allows you to be creative with the uses and think of you could use the spaces effectively and efficiently. It's fun and makes the social spaces more sacred. Someone else says, a completely energy efficient home would be ideal for me, especially in a society that is desperately trying to combat global warming by reducing the reliance on harmful means of obtaining power and electricity. Energy passive homes could have the potential to sustain growing populations without being a burden to the well-being of the world's environment. Someone else says, a totally passive solar building would be the best for the future. Looking forward, conservation is key. If a building has the ability to not need energy, then why waste it unnecessarily? So I'd given kind of multiple options, and option one was yes, totally, all of these kind of were that option. Someone else is also saying, option one, I think this is super important because being able to have a building that distributes heat and coolness is a bonus for the building itself. There are times when I don't want to depend on air conditioning. Instead, I want to feel the breeze of the air. The reason for this is because I would feel more relaxed and comfortable in my home. Now, not everyone was that enthusiastic. Someone else says, I chose the second option. I definitely think thermal design will have a tremendous impact on homes, especially with the emphasis society places on energy conservation. However, I do not completely buy into it. I fear complete obedience to thermal design will impede the architect's freedom of design and will place restrictions on how they design. I support the architect's creativity as well as sustainable design. Similarly, someone says, I believe option two is the best. While aesthetics are important, saving energy is vital to the longevity of the human race. But it doesn't necessarily mean we should live in completely self-sufficient structures. Both are important, saving energy and enjoying an aesthetic atmosphere. Finally, someone says, in 10 years, the thermal characteristics of my house will not be a top priority. I believe that the technology for cooling and heating will be even more advanced than it is now, and so it will be the best option for controlling the house's temperature. Now, all of that is relevant for the discussion today because the Twitter card question is going to be very parallel. I'm going to be asking you in 10 years, if you're buying a house, what is the importance of the issues we're dealing with today, these issues of function? So be thinking about that as we go through the lecture. So I'm going to posit that there's something kind of inherent in human behavior that makes us want to designate certain places for certain uses and then organize those for ourselves. You can actually see this in the animal kingdom. Many animals will actually designate territories. This is my territory. This is your territory. This is for my family. This is for your family. This is where we sleep. Even apes, chimpanzees, primates, they organize certain uses and they designate certain spaces for those uses. And it just seems to be a part of mammal, primate, life. And I would argue that we as human beings have a much stronger propensity toward that, maybe than we acknowledge or understand. It's very interesting to me. I lived in Australia for a while. I was particularly fascinated with Aborigine culture in Australia and made many trips to the outback to talk with Aborigines and to observe their communities. And there were some tales I heard, not sure they're 100% true, but I'll just convey to you these stories that I heard from Aborigine people about their attitude toward this and how that might have been similar or different to Western culture as it came in and colonized Australia. So the story I was told was that in the old days, Aborigines were all nomadic. They're one of the few cultures on the face of the globe that actually did not build buildings. They lived in a fairly salubrious climate. It's not terribly, terribly hot. It's not terribly, terribly cold. It's temperate for most of the year. So they actually didn't build buildings. And so you would say, well, they just didn't have architecture. And I would argue, no, actually, they did have architecture. They just didn't have physical buildings. But they did very much designate and organize uses. So they were nomadic, and when they would come to a new area, the leaders in their little family tribes would designate certain places for certain uses. So they would say, from that patch of alder trees over there to the little stream over here, that's going to be the sacred space. And for the time we're living here, that's the place where we do spiritual things, where we have our ceremony. This space over here, that's going to be where the young men will hang out and where they'll have their social life, between the rock outcropping over there and the, you know, patch of shrubs over here. And over in this area over here, this is where the young women are going to have their community and their socializing. And that's going to be between that stream and the rock outcropping over there. And they would use natural landmarks to designate certain places for certain uses. And for the period of time when that community was there, they would use it that way. And if you violated that, it was a serious problem. So if some young guy started trying to hang out in the area that was for the young women, he was completely ostracized, he was punished, he was told, no, go back and you belong in this area. If you had, let's say you needed to take a leak, you'd go over to the area that, you know, was designated as the spiritual space, oh my God, huge transgression. That was not something you were supposed to do. So there were very clear designating and organizing of uses there. This is the place where we do our cooking. This is the place where the elders stay and confer and have their conferences. All of those things are very clearly laid out, although they're not building anything. Now, it was very interesting that then when the Brits came and they settled Australia, for the most part, the Brits were on the coast and the Aborigines were on the interior. So there wasn't a lot of mixing of the two cultures. But by the 1950s and 1960s, the Brits were beginning to feel a little bad about how the Aborigines were living. So the Brits came in and they built their nice little cottages and houses. And here were the Aborigines and they had no houses. And the Brits thought, this is a problem. We need to provide housing for the Aborigine people. So they decided, the government, to have a housing project and to remedy this problem. So they would go into the Aborigine territories and they would build their little brick and tile Australian houses. It was a very classic brick and tile Australian house, brick walls and tile roof. And little like 3-bedroom, 1-bath Australians only had 1 bathroom in their house, no matter how many kids, no matter how many bedrooms, you just had 1 bath. So 3 bedrooms, 1 bath, living room, dining room, kitchen, the normal kind of little Australian house. And they built these and they said, well, this is our gift to you, the Aboriginal people. Yeah, move in, enjoy these houses. So the Aborigine people moved into those houses. And, a few months later, the officials go back and visit and they're horrified. The Aborigines they moved into this house and the first thing they did was tore a hole in the roof. Oh my God, that perfectly good tile roof. Right in the middle of the living room, they tore a hole in the roof. And they're actually cooking on a stove in the middle of that living room and letting the heat and the smoke from the stove exhaust out the hole in the roof. And they're horrified at that. You've destroyed this house. And the Aborigines say, well, you know, we always cook communally. We always cook together. Why would one person cook just for their little family of 4 people? We cook for 40 people. And the only room that was big enough for 3 or 4 people to do the cooking was this living room, that kitchen thing that was tiny. We couldn't possibly cook in there. So we had to cook in the biggest room in the house, which was a living room. And we had to somehow exhaust the smoke from the fire. And we need a hole in the ceiling in order to do that. So we just made this work, made it function for the way that we cook, which is communally. For them, the notion of cooking in individual small units and eating that way, that was crazy. And when you think about it, it's crazy. Why would you operate that way? So that was dismaying to the Australian authorities. Then they also observed that, you know, this perfectly good 3-bedroom house and 20 people are sleeping in one master bedroom and the other bedrooms are empty. Why are all these people sleeping in this one room? And the Aborigines say, well, we always sleep communally. It's cold at night here. It's kind of a desert temperature with a high diurnal swing, warm during the day, but chilly at night. You know, we all cuddle up together and, you know, we sleep together. And that's the way we've always done it. Why would we need these separate little rooms for one or two people to sleep in each room, that's crazy. So the building didn't function for the way that they lived. And we can see there this big conflict between function and lifestyle and how someone operates and a physical environment that was being provided. So it points to the idea that every culture has its own norms and has its own requirements for how they live, and buildings, in their best iteration, actually respond to those very particular characteristics and functions. So just to show a happy ending to that story, this is a house that was designed for specifically Aborigine lifestyle. The architect is Glenn Murcutt, fantastic Australian architect. This one was done in the 1990s. And in this case, Glenn, who loves Aborigine culture, he had a client, Marika Alderton. This particular client, she's an artist, and she sold her Aborigine art, and she had some means. And so she hires Glenn, and he does what is meant to be a very Aborigine house. So you can see that it responds in climate to a lot of things we were talking about in the final lecture of the last segment. So we definitely see the deep eaves that are protecting the building from the hot Australian sun. Long faces are north and south, short faces are east and west. All of those sort of classic manipulations that we looked at last time. But inside, this is really responding to the way an Australian family lives. And now, an Aborigine family lives. And now it is a little bit of a blend because these people have been influenced by Western ways of living, but they still are very much Aborigine people. So they have a big area on the left of that plan. My pointer is kind of out of gas here, but you can see on the left of the plan this big room, and that is the room for cooking and eating. And it is a big room, big enough for 20, 30 people to get in there together, to cook at this big open area, and to then, have their meal communally together. And then on the right-hand side of the plan, and here on the right picture, we're seeing that big communal cooking and eating area. And then we're seeing that what are sort of bedrooms, these little mildly partitioned areas, but you can see that it's all open above. So it really is not like a complete room. It's open to the ceiling and acoustically completely connected to all the other bedrooms. And these people have four kids, so each of the four kids gets a little cubicle in this smaller room, and the parents at the end, and the one little bathroom that they share together. But it's meant to be a part of this larger cultural lifestyle of a much more communal way of living. There also are very specific things about their culture. So, for example, because they didn't have buildings, there is a tradition there of if I want to go visit you, what I would do is I'd go over near where you were hanging out, and I would just kind of stand there, maybe 15, 20 yards away from you. And I'd just stand there and hang out. And you'd look over and you'd realize, well, he's available. And if you wanted to talk to me or invite me to, come over, then you'd say, Larry, come on over. But if you wanted your privacy and you weren't in the mood, then you just don't say anything. And I hang out for 5 minutes or so. I get the message and I leave. It's a very kind of civilized approach to, instead of ringing the doorbell and then, okay, you're confronted with, are you going to invite me in? Are you not going to invite me in? There's a very sort of sensitive and delicate way of either hooking up and visiting or not. So in the Marika Alderton house, Glenn Murcutt is dealing with that same thing. So on the left here is the front door, which actually doesn't have a door because they're accustomed to living indoor, outdoor, no closure. The whole house has no doors and no windows because that's how they're accustomed to living. So there is this screen made of wooden slats, and that screen is such that you can see out, but people can't see in. because it's darker inside and it's more light outside. So if a visitor comes and kind of hangs out over here outside, I can see that they're out there. They can stand there for a few minutes and I can either say, "Yo, Larry, yeah, come on in," or ignore them. And they know after a little while to split. They're not in the mood for visiting right now. So even though it's become more architecture, it still is embodying those functional needs of this Australian family. So the point here is this kind of deep, embedded cultural need for designating and organizing uses. And it really is the way we do that is it establishes our social relationships. It describes how we live and how we relate to each other. So I'm going to make the argument that there are three reasons why this has always been the case, why this seems to be just fundamental to human behavior and human nature. One is that this is just practical. It is extremely practical to designate and organize uses. If you've got little kids and you're cooking, you do not want the little kids playing in the area where you're cooking with an open fire. That's ridiculous. That's stupid. It's not practical to do that. So even in the most primitive of cultures, they designate an area for the kids to play, and they designate an area for cooking, and there's a separation of those two functions. It's just practical. The second reason is that this is a way of embedding social values and taboos in a culture. So actually, in Aborigine culture, the reason why they said this is the area for the young men to hang out, and this is the area for the young women to hang out, and they should be separated by gender, it was just a freaking birth control method. Because if the boys and the girls at that age are hanging out together, they're getting friendly, they're getting curious, pretty soon they're having babies. But if you can keep them separate and they're not interacting with each other, then that doesn't happen so fast. It slows down the process. And they needed birth control. They had limited resources. They needed to keep the population down. They needed some device for embedding that cultural value in their people. And so it became taboo to mix an area where guys would hang out and an area where young women would hang out. So a second important reason for doing this is to embed cultural values and taboos. The third thing is that there just seems to be something in us that wants to claim a space, that wants to say, this is mine and this is yours. This is my family's and this is your family's. This is my tribe and this is your tribe. This is my nation and this is your nation. There's something, and boy, it's deep and it's hard and it's kind of wired into us. And we can see it in global politics, and we can see it down to the level of, wait a second, your lawnmower crossed over and mowed my yard, and that's wrong. This is mine and that's yours. So this kind of intrinsic need to claim space is played out in the way we designate and organize uses. This is, I'm in control of this. I'm organizing this and using this in this way. Even a little kid, sometimes when they're playing in, maybe they commandeer their family room and they have this fantasy of play in their family room. And you walk in and you sit down in your favorite chair and they say, no, Dad, that you can't sit there. That's the teacher's chair. And that's that kid claiming this space and organizing it in their own way and making it their own. And it's a way of differentiating yourself, of having a selfness and expressing it in this designating and organizing uses. So those are three things that I think are just eternal. We do it because it's practical. We do it because it's a way of embedding cultural values and taboos. We do it because it's a way of claiming spaces. Then I think there are two reasons why we designate and organize spaces that maybe are more particular to contemporary society. And this is just kind of the way we are in the 20th and 21st century. Number one, we are so about efficiency and convenience. Now, that's not historically been the case necessarily. In Aborigine culture, time is not money, and they're not particularly interested in efficiency. And the way they designate and organize uses isn't particularly efficient. But today, we're very interested in efficiency. We want to know how far is it between my desk and the printer where I can make the prints of this thing I'm working on. And if it's 25 steps, that's too much. It needs to be only 10 steps. That's efficient. Do I have a space nearby me, where nearby my house, where my kids can play? Do I have to get in a car and go to the park in order to throw the football around? Or is there a little corner park in my neighborhood where the kids can go and romp and swing, have swing sets and play equipment and that sort of thing? That's convenient. So we're interested now in efficiency and convenience in a way that prior cultures have not necessarily been, because we're very conscious of time and spending time and how that works with our lives. Another recent phenomena is that now we have so many accoutrements, so much equipment that we build into our lives. So now we cook with a dishwasher and a disposal and a sink and a refrigerator and a microwave and a oven and a cooktop, and all of those accoutrements, all of those machines need to be in a space, and they're plugged in and they're fixed. And so many of our activities now are based on machines that assist us with that activity that has begun to make this designating and organizing uses even more important. We can't now cook in the kind of informal way that maybe even our great-grandparents might have cooked, where food preparation was relatively machine-free. Now it's so important that we have to have a designated place for it, and it has to be well organized. So two kind of new reasons for dealing with this: our infatuation with efficiency and convenience, and our propensity to need equipment and machines. So today, we're really going to be looking at how these issues of function, of designating and organizing uses, have shaped architecture through history, how they shape architecture today, how they shape architecture in residential environments, how they shape architecture in more institutional or collective environments, how they shape architecture of the city, and how the city is organized. So that's, we're looking for the manifestation of this in the built environment. So if we roll back to sort of important historical moments in architectural history, we see that this is a seminal element that is shaping new directions in architecture. We talked about a couple of lectures ago, Santa Maria della Fiore in Florence, and we talked about Filippo Brunelleschi as one of the two people who kind of invented the Renaissance in Italy, in Florence, birthed in the 15th century. The other guy was Alberti, and he also was working in Florence in the same period of time. But whereas Brunelleschi was working on the dome of Santa Maria della Fiore, Alberti was working more at the scale of ordinary buildings in the city, fabric buildings in the city, but again, completely rethinking how those would be done. So this is one of his early works, the Palazzo Rucellai. This would have been a palace for a very wealthy family in Florence. And he's thinking through, maybe for the first time in residential architecture, he's thinking about function. How does this family operate? How could that inspire the nature of this palace that I'm designing? So you've got to kind of roll back here. Right now, this is on a street in Florence that has like Ferragamo over here and Gucci over here. And it's a very chic, high-end neighborhood in Florence. But at the time, this would have been a little medieval city that had not yet been affected by this Renaissance thinking. So basically, it's a lot of little twisty, windy streets. And you got to think also, this is pre-automobile, way pre-automobile. So they're getting around with horses and beasts of burden. And so the streets are full of horse shit, literally. They've got carts and they've got, and the paving is not the best. And so it's muddy and it's smelly. And there are a lot of questionable characters in Florence. And so even though this is a very wealthy family, the neighborhood is a very mixed neighborhood, and there are all kinds of people there. So down on that lower floor, the street is not a real friendly place to be. It's smelly, it's dirty, it's maybe even dangerous at some times. So Alberti thinks, what are the functions that might go adjacent to this street that would be appropriate for the family and their operation? So he thinks, okay, well, I don't want to have my living areas associated with that street. It's too nasty. So we'll put the storerooms, we'll put the places where we keep our, we'll put the stable where we keep our horses and our buggies. We'll put the place where we store the hay and the feed for the horses. We'll put the coal storage where for heating our house. We'll put some of the servants' quarters because they didn't treat their servants that well. We'll put all of those kind of nasty things in the lower level, right at the street level. And in a way, we'll kind of wall the building off, and it'll be very solid with very tiny windows just for ventilation. And that will be all of these just service functions down there. And then we will... You'll drive in through one of these gates with your buggy, and you'll go into a courtyard, and then you'll go up a grand stair in the courtyard, and you'll go to the second level, which is the piano nobile, or the noble floor, and that's where your living room and your drawing room and your salon and your music room and those places where you entertain your other fancy friends, they're now up away from the street, and they're on that noble floor, the piano nobile, and they're all associated together. And so your friends, when they come, they disgorge from their buggies, they get out in the courtyard, they go up this grand stair, and you have a party up on that second floor. And then on the third floor, that's where your real family quarters are, and that'd be the bedrooms and also the kind of family rooms and even a little dining area just for family functions up there. So this is a vertical separation of functions and reactions to different conditions and different lifestyle issues of that Renaissance family. Now, that motif of the Renaissance palazzo, solid on the bottom level, piano nobile on the second level, we talked about when we looked at Battle Hall, when we toured around on the campus, and that was based on Renaissance palazzos. It also had the sort of mundane functions on the bottom level, the reading room for the library up on the second level. It's based on the same functional reaction. Now, it's a beautiful building. It's got this kind of graciousness that comes from having that fancy floor on the second level. But it's driven by function. It really was a reaction to how you organize the uses in this house. A few years later, we have Brunelleschi. Again, this... buddy of Alberti, cohort in establishing the Renaissance. Brunelleschi is doing a fancy palazzo on the other side of the Arno River in Florence for the Pitti family. So in Palazzo Pitti, he's doing pretty much the same thing as Alberti was doing. But now this is a much grander family and a much bigger house. And they've got lots of servants and lots of stables. And so that ground floor is much bigger and much more expansive. And even the articulation of it, he uses rough stones on the bottom there so that he shows you this is mundane operation. There's not finely cut stone. There's just rough, rubbly stone on the bottom. And that's for certain functions. And then on the second level, this is, again, a family that entertains rather lavishly. So there's quite a large second level for the piano nobile. But then there are only so many family members, and when you get to the top level, it's much smaller, and just has those functions just for the family. So now the massing of the building, the material usage of the building, it's all explaining to you what the function was about. Again, function is the driver here. Now, next, I want us to look at an occurrence in the 19th century where in American homes, there was this transition from homes that were based on form to homes that were based on function. And the first example here is on the left, we have the Longfellow House in Cambridge, Massachusetts. On the right, we have the Jeremiah Lee Mansion in Marlborough, Massachusetts. Both of these are, I would say, form-driven houses. They're very symmetrical. They've got sometimes these are called front hall colonial houses. You walk in the front door, there's a hall that goes all the way through. It has the stair in it. That's the hall that goes all the way through and has the stair in it. And then there would be four rooms in each of the four corners. And they're just kind of generic rooms. They might be a family room, they might be a music room, they might be a parlor, they might be a dining room, they might be a kitchen. But those four rooms are all designed pretty much the same size. They have pretty much the same kind of window because you want them all to be symmetrical. And then on the second floor, there are four bedrooms in those same locations. But again, they're all about the same size. They're all about the same shape. They have the same kind of window. They even have the same kind of window as on the ground floor. So basically, you've got eight rooms that are generic rooms. They're not very specific to their function. You can label them and you can use them however you want to do it. And that was a typical colonial house in America in the 19th century. And then in the latter part of the 19th century, a guy came along named H.H. Richardson. We've looked at his work before in northeastern Massachusetts when we were looking at physical considerations and the way he built in masonry. But this Richardson guy, he starts thinking, you know, this is not really accommodating of the kind of lifestyle of families of this period. And I'm going to make something that really responds to function, and I'm going to make a house that grows out of that function. So basically, across the street from the Longfellow House that we see in the slide on the left was a house designed by Richardson called the Stoughton House. And he's designing this house for the Stoughton family and thinking very, very much about how does the building function? How does the family function? How does the house become a reflection of their lifestyle? So you would come in off the street to a porch, to a porch that's right there. Off that porch is a little vestibule. You enter in. And in society at this time, the Stoughtons would be a fairly well-off family, and they would be members of kind of elite society in Cambridge. And in this society, there was a habit of declaring a certain day as your at-home day. And so for my family, the Specks might have their at-home day on Thursday. And so that would mean that if you're one of the other families in our social group, you're invited to come over anytime you want on Thursday. And so you would come to the front door, the butler would take your coat, and you would present a card. And your card would have your name or your family's name on it. And the butler would then take that card up to the Speck family on the second floor and present the card and say, the Joneses are here. And in the meantime, they would have come in the front door there, and the butler would have put them in the reception room right here. So you need, for this ritual of receiving people, you need this reception room. The butler would go up, deliver the card, then the family members, the woman or the guy or whoever, would come down and greet those visitors. And then if there was women, they would go into the living room right here. If it was guys, they would go into the study right there. So there was this very formal device of how you greeted your visitors, a space for that, where the women went and where the men went. The men would talk business or politics. The women would talk families and cooking and fashion and things like that. Very stratified society. Now, when they had a party, you would have that same receiving room right here. But then the party would go into the dining room right there. And they would have a nice dining room table. Everybody sits down. You have a very formal meal there. You're being served by servants. There's a butler's pantry right there. There is the kitchen right there. They would cook in the kitchen. They would plate the food in the butler's pantry. That's where all the dishes and silverware would be stored. They would then serve it out to the dining room there. And then the servants would all disappear in this direction. And there was a separation of the servants' end of the house and the family and guest end of the house. And yet everything is organized just right, so there's not any conflict between that. So deliveries would be made off the service side of the house. There's even a separate stair for the servants to go up and change the sheets on the bed, to clean the bathrooms upstairs, but not use the formal stair here. Use the back stair, the servant stair on that side of the house. Now, as you can see, compared with the Longfellow house or the Jeremiah Lee house, that's a simple rectangle divided into little rooms. But now the Stoughton house becomes this organic thing. There really is growing out of the way this family lives and the relationships of different activities and how they would have just the right shape and form for dining. The dining room is particular to the function of dining. The study is particular to guys sitting around smoking their cigars, talking politics, having books all around the room. There's just a character there that is perfect for those activities that went on there. Each room is expressing its function and the relation of that function to other functions in the house. And that happens in three dimensions, too. That receiving room, this is a cover of the New Yorker that shows the front hall of the Stoughton house. And you can see that grand stair. You can imagine the woman of the house coming down in her elegant gown and greeting her friend who's also dressed to the nines on their Thursday afternoon at-home day. And she's making an entrance. It is specific to that function of receiving. And there needs to be a kind of three-dimensional expression of that. On the left, you can see the exterior appearance of the house. We see very clearly that stairwell in that sweeping, more curvilinear, circular form with the kind of turret at the top. We see the living room with bigger windows, above it the master bedroom with smaller windows. All of these expressing the character, the function, the privacy, the public orientation of various pieces and parts of the house. A house driven by function. Same thing is happening in another house by H.H. Richardson. This was in Chicago, the Glessner House. This actually was a guy who was a corporate giant in Chicago. He actually had a little problem with his workers from time to time. There were big labor disputes and riots against this guy. So he had a kind of a fortified house, a very walled-off house that was oriented to a courtyard in the back, as you can see in the plan on the left there. And again, everything is so carefully made to respond to function. So you would come in from the front door here, and you go up a few stairs and into... Excellent, maybe we got a little better... perfect, into the reception hall right there. That same function of coming in, the big stair that comes down and greets you in the reception hall. From that, you go this direction to his study over here. You go in the other direction to the living room. That's where the women would gather there. It's a little grander house, so now we have a music room right there. So the guests might come for a party, and you'd listen to music in that room there. And then they'd proceed to the dining room. The dining room is all about gathering around a table. The shape and form of it is reflecting the function of that dining hall right there. Then, of course, the kitchen and the butler's pantry that serve into the dining hall. This one, much more elaborate, kind of stables for the horses. That would be an important servant function over there. All of the storage areas for their goods that feeds into the kitchen, the butler's pantry, the dining hall. A little corridor here that lets the servants go back and forth and magically pop in and serve hors d'oeuvres to the guest here and then be able to disappear and go back to the kitchen. Again, everything thinking through what is their lifestyle, how do we make it as unobtrusive as possible for everyone to do what they need to do and not interfere with each other. Against the street, very tight, kind of fortified house there. On the courtyard, a much more loose agglomeration of forms that talk about stairwell, and that circular stair that goes up from the study to the master bedroom there. Talks about the dining hall here, that curvilinear shape. And then this is actually the servant's entrance, different from the kind of guest entrance on the front of the house. As we move in, those stairs that go up to the reception hall here, off to one side is his study, a kind of real atmosphere that's a real guy room, real heavy wood, very masculine kind of environment, again, expressing that function. Into the music room over here, from the music room into the dining room. The dining room, everyone gathered around the table, that bay window reflecting the shape of the table and the gathering of the people inside, and then up to the bedroom on the upper floor. Now, I want you to think for a minute about the function of houses that you've lived in your life, or maybe houses that you've experienced, a friend's house, your grandma's house, your cousin's house. Are there examples you can think of residential environments that reinforce positively the lifestyle, the family values of that particular family? Are there times when you can think of instances where the physical environment, the organization of uses in that house seem to be in conflict or actually caused problems with the way the family functioned or the way they wanted to live, but the house did not accommodate that well. So I want you to think about this, and I want to get a couple of examples from you if I can. So think about this. I think this is really fundamental. Sometimes conflict between siblings can be tracked to how their bedrooms are related to each other or not related to each other. When I was growing up, I had a sister who was 4 years younger than I was, and I had a sister that was 14 years younger than I was. I had a brother who was 2.5 years older than I was. My brother and I shared a bedroom. All the time we were growing up, it was a big bedroom. It was a cool bedroom. It had a pool table in it when we were teenagers. It was a great room. And never, ever did we complain a minute about sharing a bedroom. We had a cool room. We got along really well. We were great friends. And this bedroom was perfect for us. So when my youngest sister was born, my parents imagined, well, the girls will be wonderful friends also. We'll have them share a bedroom too. And so my youngest sister immediately moves into the room with her 10-year-old sister. And the older sister was like horrified. What is this bratty little kid doing in my room? And from day one, it was conflict, 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 conflict. She was miserable. My younger sister, as she was growing up, she was like, she was the pariah. She was treated as such. Finally, when my younger sister was about 5 years old, my parents gave up on it, said, okay, that was a stupid move, and they built an extra bedroom. And that allowed my youngest sister to have a separate bedroom, my other sister to have a separate bedroom. Because the physical environment was aggravating incredible conflict. in the family. The solution was to designate and organize uses in a different way in the family. And after that, my two sisters got along much better. So can you think of examples of environments that you've experienced that where the function really worked or the function really didn't work? Yeah.
In Middle Eastern culture, we have what I call the vanity room. It's the one where none of the kids can go into and sit down, but it has all the nice stuff and the nice couches. And in the Middle East, that's the first room you see when you walk into many of the homes because you want the best for your guests. Uh-huh. So in the U.S., a lot of the homes that my family's lived in aren't designed that way. So we've kind of, my parents and grandparents have made rooms that aren't vanity rooms or designed to be, make them fit. Uh-huh. So it's pretty funny to try to see that happen.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So you take a regular house and now you're trying to retrofit it to fit a culture that really did make houses that had that. And I've seen plenty of these Middle Eastern houses. It's really kind of cool. I've been in Kuwait where you go in and the first room is this very impressive room. But none of the kids are ever allowed in that. That's just for the guests and the adults. And so they're trying to retrofit and maybe not perfectly. That's cool. Other examples. Places you can think of that the architecture reinforces a way of living or fails to reinforce it. Come on, guys, think about it. So what do you think? Yeah.
So my grandparents have a lake house, and it's three stories, but it's two stories on the front because it's built on a hill. And then there's a basement floor that goes out to the backyard, and it goes down to the lake, and there's a fire pit down there and everything. And my grandparents live on the middle floor, which is the first floor from the front side. And it's really good because we have, like, dinner in that floor, and everyone gathers there. But when my family all comes and stays at my grandparents' house, there's an attic floor that has a couple rooms that are kind of cramped and like poorly air conditioned and such. But then there's the basement floor that's heated from the floors because it's in Wisconsin. And they have really nice bedrooms down there. So it's kind of been a conflict where like my parents got the room in the basement first and my brother and I got a room too because we're the oldest grandkids. But the other uncle and aunts, they got really upset because they were in these cramped rooms with their babies upstairs, and now it's kind of crowded. So that's kind of an issue with, like, it's just getting too crowded, and they argue about like who gets the nice room downstairs versus the ones upstairs.
That's a great example, and that's one of those situations where that house might have worked really well at a certain stage of their lives. Now they've got two adult kids. They've both got families. What they need is a wing for one family and their kids and a wing for another family and their kids, and they need to be equal, but in fact, that's not what there is, and it creates conflict. This happens all the time, and it actually, I maybe will overstate the case here, but I actually think that for many, many families, maybe family counseling is a really important thing, but what they really need is a decent house that actually works for them. That often the kinds of conflicts between siblings, conflicts between grandchildren, conflicts between even husband and wife, some of these things can be resolved much better if, in fact, the physical environment is accommodating of the way these people want to live, the levels of privacy, the levels of connectivity, all of those things work together. So this is a huge issue in the happiness and the well-being of people, I think, and especially in residential environments. Okay, so let's look at another kind of environment, larger scale environments. We're going to look at two libraries here and how they're really shaped by function. In the 1950s and 1960s, worldwide, there is this modernist movement. People like Le Corbusier, Mies van der Rohe, Frank Lloyd Wright, we've talked about those people and the way that they advocated a different kind of architecture. Le Corbusier is very famous for a dictum that he pronounced in the 1920s in a book called Toward a New Architecture, where he's thinking, how should architecture change? And he's making an argument for function, and that function should be a bigger driver in the way we make buildings. And he said that a house should be a machine for living in. Now, that's been misinterpreted a lot into saying that a house should look like a machine. That's not actually what he was saying at all. He's saying that a house should operate like a machine, where a machine is all of the pieces and parts are doing their job in an extremely efficient way. They're all related to each other in such a way that they reinforce each other. And the house should be like a machine for living in that all those pieces and parts need to function perfectly. That then led to a whole idea about many kinds of buildings as how do we think of them almost like a machine? All the parts are working perfectly together. And this is a building by James Stirling several decades later at Cambridge in England, the university there. And this was a whole building that was built for the history faculty. And it actually is, it's more than a library. It is where the classrooms for the history department are, all the faculty offices for the history department. This is where all the history students would hang out. And because they're studying history, and this is in the 1960s, the study of history has everything to do with books. And they're constantly reading books and interacting with books. So the library is the central function. And in Cambridge, they have a wonderful collection, history collection. So their library is very precious, and it's a central function. So James Stirling puts the library, this sort of terraced glass form here, that's the library. And the library becomes the central function of the history faculty building. And pretty much every decision about this building, the way it looks, the materials, the shape, the form, the plan, it's all going back to function. So you would come in from the campus in two different directions here. There's a kind of lobby space that would have elevators off to the side here. Those are those elevators right there. You'd come in from the campus here or on the other side. Right in front of you as you come in is the library. It says that the study of history is all about books, and the library is right there. You walk right in, there's the circulation desk, so you can get help, and and also that person is kind of supervising the entrance. That was back in the card catalog day, so there's the card catalog off to the side. And then this library is designed beautifully for function. From that front desk, you can see all the way through the entire library. So there's complete surveillance. You've got the reading room through here. You've got the book stacks through there on two different levels. You've got the little study rooms off to the side there. But that person supervising can see absolutely everything in the entire library, including in between the stacks, so that, you know, little naughtiness happened there. Boom, got them, nailed, because the complete surveillance of the entire library. And then that would be that big cascading form. So in three dimensions, very clear, this is the central feature of the whole history faculty building. There you see in section that big library space, the double height stacks here. And then the rest of the building stacked on top of it has classrooms, smaller seminar rooms, and then faculty offices. So stacked above in this L-shaped tower are the most public functions, those classrooms with the largest number of people on the lower levels. The less public functions, the seminar rooms with smaller numbers of people above that, and the most private functions, the faculty offices up at the top. All of those things share a corridor here. That corridor looks down into this big library space right there. But it is a perfect diagram of most public to least public, of library in the center, of circulation that all looks down into that public library space, and actually does a wonderful job of giving a sense of community to all of the people who are a part of this history faculty, this community of people studying history. Little niches for people to sit off to the off of the corridor there and look down into that library space. Lots of natural light spilling down into that space. The library itself kind of perfectly organized in terms of what function goes where, and easy surveillance of the whole thing. And really, the architecture is just a three-dimensional expression of the diagram of how this building works. And then even on the outside, we see the expression of the corridor is in glass. We see the difference between the larger lecture halls, the seminar rooms, the faculty offices as it steps up here. We see the elevators as vertical circulation right there. And of course, we see the big cascading form of the reading room of the library right there. Everything in this building, every decision about form, about material, about character, about spatial quality, it all goes back to function. What are the uses? How are they related to each other? How do we express that? A very different kind of library. This one is on the campus of Exeter Academy, snotty prep school up in New England. This is an institution that's been around since the 18th century, and this is their old main building. It's in a kind of Georgian red brick vocabulary. So they're building a brand new central library for this whole prep school campus. And it's right in the center of the campus and has a lot to do with the historical character of the other buildings around. It blends very nicely into this sort of red brick campus of Exeter Academy. The architect is Lou Kahn. We've looked at Lou Kahn's work at the Bryn Mawr Dorm, at a couple of lectures ago at the Kimball Museum in Fort Worth, one of the premier architects of the 20th century. But the way this building is organized on the campus is very much about function. So, the campus is complete. It's an old campus. People would have thought, well, there's no place for a new library. Or if there's a place for a library, it's going to have to be on the periphery of the campus, where we haven't built so much. But instead, Lou Kahn said, no, this is a very, very central function. It needs to go right in the center of the campus. And on one of the kind of prominent quadrangles of the campus, the library sits right there in the middle of the campus. And that's because functionally, that's what the library is. It's a central function of the campus. It was also meant to be kind of ceremonially. This is the place where some activities, ceremonial activities would take place. So it needed to be kind of the most iconic, the most present building on the campus. So he puts it right there in the middle. And on the ground floor, there's an arcade all the way around the bottom. And that means that no matter where you're coming from the campus, it doesn't face one direction. It faces all directions because its function is meant to reach out to dormitories in one area, sports facilities in another area, classroom buildings in another area, dining halls in another area. All of those things are coming together in the library. So that arcade collects people around the ground floor. Then as you enter the arcade, you would circulate around to the actual place where you penetrate. You go in the front door. You're then taken up a very grand stair, not so different from the piano nobile experience that we saw in the Renaissance Palazzos or in Battle Hall, our library here on this campus. And then you go up to the major floor, is that upper floor, one level above the ground there. And then within the building, there is this very clear organization of uses. There is a great ceremonial space at the center of the building, this huge, tall atrium space, natural light that comes in from above, a very grand scale. That's where the great ceremonies of the campus would be held. And then around that most public space is a kind of semi-public space, ringing all the way around here, that ceremonial space in the center, the semi-public space around here. In that semi-public space, you get book stacks that's available to everyone. You get the stairwells that take you up to the upper floors. You get the bathrooms, which are shared by everyone. All of those kinds of functions are in this second ring around here. And then in the third tier of the building around the outside, you get all of the more private reading room areas, study carrels, places for more individual or small group interaction. So those three rings of the donut, the ceremonial center, the semi-public spaces around, the private study areas on the periphery, all of them have completely different architectural expressions. In the center, it's grand, it's bold, it's awesome. I mean, this is really an amazing space. Dramatic light that comes in from above, this giant geometry of those big circular forms. The material is concrete, big, bold, strong concrete forms. All of that appropriate for a very public, very majestic, very ceremonial kind of character in that central space. As you walk in, you get a sense, wow, I'm in the center of a very important institution here. This is the heart of the Exeter campus. This is a prestigious, very powerful institution I'm a part of here. Then you move into this ring around that, and it's a completely different sense of space, set of materials, kind of articulation. Now it's not this grand, big, large-scale thing. Instead, now it's broken up into much smaller spaces. Now we don't have the big concrete forms. We have just the kind of skeletal columns and beams of the concrete, reinforced concrete, as it wraps around that area. It now is in a much more touchable material, the wood, a little warmer, not the layer of the big, strong, bold concrete forms on the outside. And then as you move to that third layer on the periphery, now the material changes again. It's brick. That's a much smaller scale material, much more intimate, much more the scale of the individual sitting and studying at their study carrel or in a small group, having a little study session or in a reading area, just you and a book. The intimacy there is expressed in the kinds of windows, in the kinds of materials, in the treatment of that space altogether. All of that much more intimate and interactive with the individual. So again, it's function that's driving the whole thing. The organization of the thing is by function. The materials usage is by function. The scale of those spaces is by function. The articulation of it is by function. And then on the outside of the building, we see those functions expressed again. You get the high light that lets big, you know, generous light into the depth of the building. Then you get these tiny little windows that are the tiny scale of a study space there and the individual working at their desk, very intimate. Also in that outside ring on the top floors, these beautiful, intimate, room-like environments where you can have small group classrooms or study areas there. So again, it's driven by function. Now I want to make the point that this happens at the scale of a house, it happens at the scale of an institutional building. It also can happen at the scale of an entire campus. And this is a campus that Lu Khan designed in India, where the academic part of the campus here, the student housing here, the faculty housing there, the graduate student housing there, the servants for the faculty housing here, everything with its own function. Again, in the academic part of the campus, the faculty offices over here, the main library there, the classrooms over here, the classrooms feed into the library, the faculty offices feed into the library. The library is that big central function for the entire campus. The classroom wing of that academic building is then the closest to the student housing so they can come easily to and from their classes. Great efficiency and convenience there. Even those individual student houses, the rooms themselves separated from the more common spaces on the lower floor, those separated from the bathrooms and the stairwells on the back. Everything here at the scale of a whole campus being designated and organized by the various functions and uses. So the Twitter card question for today, I want you to think, as you did for the last lecture, what is the priority of this issue, the issue of function? And in particular, I want you to think in a house you might buy 10 years from now. And again, I'm going to give you four levels of choice. The first one is function is it. This is something that's a very top priority in my house. I absolutely think the house needs to lead with function. The second possibility is function's important. It's a high priority, but it's not the highest priority. It's something I certainly would want taken into account. The third option is, you know, not terribly important. Yeah, I'd pay some attention to it, but it's not a terribly important issue. Or the fourth thing is, my God, people can live anywhere. They don't need things organized for function. I just, you know, need some space, but I'll manage to use it however. So tell me how you would prioritize this issue of designating and organizing uses and functional organization in a house you might buy 10 years from now.